Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on destroyed arguments when we come back. You know, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school, and this class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the scene of this alleged crime, and what should you say to the police or investigators, and what you ought not to say to the police. And you'll learn how to conduct yourself in your case at bail setting, arraignment, pleadings, motion hearings, trial and appeal, and you'll learn how to ask questions, how to cross-examine adverse witnesses, select a jury, introduce exhibits and evidence, conduct discovery, do legal research, and follow the rules of court. Now, there are 28 elements to learn, 28 things that you need to know in preparing a courtroom strategy and procedure. And rule one is that all of the evidence that your opponent is ever going to use against you is going to be furnished by you. So keep your mouth shut. Don't say anything and shut up. And after rule one's out of the way, we can get to the real business of winning your case. Now, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Remember, georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about this thing of the case of Reynolds versus U.S. Reynolds, remember, was a polygamist, a Mormon polygamist, and they wanted a test case, and in the trade, we call Reynolds the goat. He's the guy that is going to be like a Rosa Parks, the person who is going to test the case. Rosa Parks got on the bus. It wasn't an accident. She sat down on the front of the bus. She knew that she was supposed to sit in the back. The bus driver told her to sit in the back of the bus, and she said no. She was arrested and jailed, and that's what creates a constitutional confrontation. The Mormons wanted to do this constitutional confrontation, and they selected one of their own, a Mormon polygamist. And I told you last time, there was no evidence in the record that Reynolds had or did not have a marriage license, but a fiction of law attached to him. You see, in order to have a civil marriage, you have to have a written contract. And this written contract is between the state, the boy, and the girl. And it's called a marriage license. A patriarchal marriage is a contract, all right, but it's a contract between the groom and the father of the bride. The bride is not a party to the contract because she is the object of the contract. She's the property being transacted. The female is property. That's why the young man goes to the father of the bride and asks for her hand in marriage. Today, you go to the state to get a license from the state to get permission. Remember, a license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal and lawful, a tort or a trespass. Now, what's illegal about marriage? More importantly, why is the state involved in marriage in the first place? Marriage is a religious business, isn't it? Marriage is something that comes from the laws of God. Marriage comes from the Bible. And isn't it the state, isn't it our government that keeps enforcing upon our consciousness this thing called the separation of church and state? Well, if we were going to have separation of church and state, why do you see the state involving itself in marriage? Why doesn't the state involve itself in communion or baptism or church on Sunday? Well, the reason is marriage is a business. and it's a business created by God. It's a social institution created by our Creator. It has nothing to do with the civil law state, but the civil law state has involved itself in marriage. Now, what we see here then is an argument called separation of church and state. But let's destroy that argument by showing you plainly the state is not separated from religion. The state wants to separate religion from the state, but the state wants to dominate and control religion. And they do that by incorporating churches. So these churches, the religious institutions, go to the state to get permission to exist. It's called a corporate charter. Now, there are 476 of these religious institutions in the United States, at last count, last time I saw some number. Probably changes from week to week, month to month, but it's around 500 denominations, sects, religious groups, and organizations that are incorporated. There's 330,000 churches in the United States. There's 6,000 that are unincorporated. 6,000 churches in this country that actually practice separation of church and state. The rest of them do not. That's a fiction. There is no separation of church and state. The church and the state are one. And the churches of America are dominated by the state. These are state churches. This is a state religion, and it is a state-controlled religion. Just ask any preacher to perform a marriage ceremony without a marriage license and see what he tells you. There isn't a preacher in America that will produce, there isn't a licensed preacher of an incorporated church, I should say, that will produce a marriage without a marriage license. Now that, boys and girls, is not separation of church and state. And when Reynolds went in and said, I am going to rely upon my First Amendment right to freedom of religion and practice polygamy, which is has 24 examples in the Bible, is created as a social institution by God Almighty Himself, and I want to practice that. Did you get that? The Supreme Court said, oh no, you can't do that, Reynolds. Because the history and the religion and the culture of America is Christianity. And the Mormons had subscribed to Christianity. And the Mormons wanted civil law marriages. And so the Mormon hierarchy in the church capitulated to the state. The Mormon church is nothing more than an adjunct of the state. It is, in fact, a state religion. And when you get married in the Mormon church, you get married with a marriage license. That didn't come from the Bible. And there's more. There's another example that I want to give you today along this line. Now that we've blown the argument on separation of church and state, there was a slave woman by the name of Celia. And back in 1855, she was tried for murdering her master. And there was no doubt but what her master had raped her a number of times. Now, was this self-defense, or was it murder? And this woman, who paid with her life on the gallows, was she an oppressed stranger in violation of the stranger's statute in the Scripture? Or was she a murderess who deserved to go to the gallows? Let me show you another example of this thing that we call destroyed arguments. Because we are told constantly by our teachers in school that the policeman is your friend. That the government is your friend. The government is a foreign and alien god, and the policeman is an agent of that foreign and alien god that the Bible tells us not to make covenants and contracts with. So we go out and make covenants and contracts in the form of marriage license, business license, birth certificate, marriage license, and on it goes with these civil law entities. Well, this lady, this slave by the name of Celia, was 14 years old. I'm going to give you a little sample of the story. Then we'll take a look in the Bible at the kidnappers and slavers statutes, and then we'll take a look at the stranger and bondservant statutes, and I'll show you that the Christian church and the Christian judges and Christian society oppressed this woman and killed her. Now, blacks have been complaining for years that there is racial discrimination in the United States. I don't know about Canada, Australia, New Zealand, but here in the United States, the blacks complain and have been complaining bitterly that they have been oppressed and that they're strangers in the land. Now, they don't use the word strangers, and they have attached the word, we were slaves in the land, and the root cause of our problem was slavery, and because of this slavery, which was the crime committed against us, we should have some kind of recompense. We should be compensated. Well, slavery is not against the law of God. It's not a violation of the scripture, any more than polygamy is. Slavery is a social status created by God Almighty Himself, statutorily provided for by Moses in the law, and we have abandoned it and turned our backs on it. The crime wasn't slavery. The crime was kidnapping and the oppression of those blacks that we brought over here to the United States. Now, kidnapping is called man-stealing in the Bible. Man-stealing, kidnapping, is punishable by death. It's a crime. So here's Christian America going to Africa, kidnapping these black Africans and bringing them to the United States, making merchandise of them. Not the slavery was against the law, but that the kidnapping was against the law. And then, when the slaves were freed, then came the oppression of the strangers within our land. Both of those are crimes punishable, and God punished us with a civil war and has punished us with those blacks from that day to this. They have been a thorn in our side from 1865 to 2005, and they will continue to be a thorn in our sides until they are finally restored to their inheritance in Africa, which comes after the second coming. So let's take a look at a story called The State of Missouri versus Celia, a Slave, 1855. The defendant, Celia, a slave. The charge is murder. Chief defense lawyers, Isaac M. Boulware, John Jameson, and Nathan Chapman Coons. The chief prosecutor was Robert Prewitt. The judge, William Hall Place. It was conducted in Callaway County, Missouri. The date of the trial, October the 9th and 10th, 1855. The verdict was guilty and the sentence, hanging. The significance of this case graphically illustrates that enslaved women had no legal recourse when they were raped by their masters. And although the second article of Section 29 of the Missouri Statutes of 1845 forbade anyone to take any woman unlawfully, against her will and by force, menace, or duress, compel her to be defiled, Judge William Hall refused to instruct the jury that the enslaved Celia fell within the meaning of any woman, and giving the jury no latitude to consider Celia's murder of her sexually abusive master a justifiable act of self-defense. Now, in 1850, the recently widowed Robert Newsom purchased the 14-year-old Celia, ostensibly to help his daughters with the housework. En route from Audrain County, the site of the transaction, to his own home in neighboring Callaway County, Missouri, Newsom raped the young girl. Back at his farm, Newsom ensconced her in a small cabin 150 feet from his home. Between 1850 and 1855, Celia bore two of Newsom's children, both of whom became her master's property. She also began a relationship with a fellow slave named George, and when she became pregnant in 1855, she was unsure which of the men was the father. At that point, George, the other slave, told Celia that he would have nothing more to do with her if she did not quit the old man. Celia first asked Newsom's daughters to intercede, and she told Mary, 19 years old, as was Celia in 1855, and Virginia, 36, and returned to her father's home with her own three children, that her pregnancy was making her feel unwell, and that she wished Robert Newsom to respect her condition and leave her alone. There is no indication that either Newsom daughter challenged her father. Celia herself pleaded with Newsom on June 23rd, but he brushed aside her objections and said he was coming to her cabin that night. That afternoon, Celia brought a heavy stick, about as large as the upper part of a Windsor chair, but not quite as long, into her cabin. When Newsom arrived and refused to back off, she killed him with two blows to the head, and she spent the night burning his body in the fireplace. As morning approached, she ground the smaller bones into pieces with a rock. The larger bones she hid under the hearth and under the floor between a sleeper and the fireplace. Later that day, she gave Newsom's unwitting grandson, Virginia's son Coffee Wazencott, two dozen walnuts to carry the ashes out. Coffee disposed of his grandfather's remains on the ground beside a bare down-like path on the property. Now Celia speaks. By Sunday, June 24th, Newsom's family and neighbors had become concerned. They first questioned George, who quickly implicated Celia. George afterward ran away. Harry and David Newsom, Robert's sons, had come from their own homes to investigate. With Robert's neighbor, William Powell, they demanded a confession from Celia. She at first denied any involvement. Then, afraid of Harry and David's reaction, she told Powell that she would confess if he would send the two men out of the room. They left, and Celia told her story to Powell. Powell and the Newsom family then examined the fireplace where Virginia located buttons my sister Mary sewed on my father's breeches, a few days before his death, and various splinters of bone. Newsom's larger bones were then recovered from the hiding space beneath the hearth. On June 25th, David Newsom delivered his affidavit to two local justices of the peace, D.M. White and Isaac P. Howe. The affidavit stated that David Newsom has cause to suspect and believe that one Negro woman named Celia, a slave of the said Robert Newsom, did at the county aforesaid feloniously, willfully, and with malice aforethought, and with a club or some other weapon, strike and mortally wound the said Robert Newsom, of which wound or wounds the said Robert Newsom instantly died. Celia was arrested and delivered forthwith to the keeper of the common jail of said county to await her trial. Let me pause right here and point out a very important element in the case. All of the evidence that is going to be used against Celia the slave is going to be furnished by Celia the slave. It was her confession. Tuck that one away in your heart. She did, in fact, tell her story, didn't she? Now, whether or not she should have told her story is another story for another date. The fact is, she told her story. Now, what is her defense? Is it premeditated murder on her part, or is it self-defense? I'll let you be the judge. And then we'll take a look at the Bible. Not at Christian religion, not at theology. We'll take a look at the law that God gave Moses at Mount Sinai concerning slaves and bondservants and kidnappers. And then let's go from there. Now, because white Callaway County residents were afraid Celia might have had help from another slave or slave still at large, County Sheriff William T. Snell permitted two men, Thomas Schoetman and Jefferson Jones, to interrogate Celia. All of the above information about Celia's life on the Newsom farm comes from her interviews with William Powell, Jefferson Jones, and Thomas Schoetman. It does not come from Celia's trial testimony because Celia gave no testimony. You see, in the 19th century, blacks generally were not allowed to testify in criminal trials. At the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established. Now the trial begins. Celia's trial began on October the 9th, 1855. Her court-appointed attorneys, Isaac M. Boulware, John Jameson, and Nathan Coons, seem to have given the most vigorous defense possible. On her behalf, they pleaded not guilty and described Celia as one who was ready for trial and prayed herself upon her God and her country. On October the 10th, the prosecutor, Robert Prewitt, called Jefferson Jones to the stand, and Jones recited for the court the account that Celia had given to him several months earlier. He said that Celia said she had been having sexual intercourse with her master and that George had threatened to leave her if these relations continued. When Jameson cross-examined Jones about Celia's account of the rape on the day of Newsom's purchase, Newsom's sexual demands during the following 5 years and the birth of her two children fathered by Newsom, Jones said that he couldn't say positively whether Celia said the accused had forced her on the way home and couldn't know with certainty whether she told me so. Robert Newsom's daughter, Virginia Wainscott, was called by the prosecutor, and she described the discovery of some of her father's remains. Jameson then cross-examined her and tried tactfully, and not very successfully, to examine the relationship between her father and the enslaved Celia. When asked where her father customarily slept, Virginia replied, "I did not notice the Newsom's bed. Sister made the bed up." Virginia did, however, disclose that Celia took sick in February, had been sick ever since. Virginia's son, Coffee Wainscott, then testified about his disposal of his grandfather's ashes, and on cross-examination, Jameson tried again, and with tact, but with little success, to elicit information about the sexual relationship between Newsom and Celia. William Powell was the next witness. The witness for the prosecution related Celia's detailed confession that she had killed Newsom. During his cross-examination of Powell, Jameson abandoned the reticence that he had shown to Newsom's daughter and grandson. Powell testified that Celia had told him of Newsom's misconduct and of her pleas to Newsom's daughters for intercession. He also testified that Celia had claimed to act only from a desperate wish to end Newsom's sexual demands. Jameson called Dr. James M. Martin, a Fulton doctor, to testify, and all of Jameson's questions to Dr. Martin concerning how long it would take to burn an adult human body brought objections from the prosecutor, which were sustained by Judge William Hall. Thomas Schopman then testified for the defense, saying that the reason that she gave for striking him the second blow was that he threw up his hands to catch her, and only to hurt him, to keep him from having sexual intercourse with her. Judge Hall ordered both of these statements stricken from the record. Jameson had valiantly tried to bring Celia's motives before the jury, and the prosecutor had fought to keep her motives from consideration. Slaves had the legal right to preserve their lives, even if the use of deadly force was required. Moreover, according to Missouri law, it was a crime to take any woman unlawfully against her will and by force, menace, or duress compel her to be defiled. A homicide committed while warding off such a crime against one's person was justifiable self-defense. Therefore, when it was time for both the prosecuting and defending attorneys to present Judge Hall with proposed instructions for the jury, Jameson asked that the jury be instructed that if they believe, from the testimony, that the said Newsom at the time of said killing attempted to compel her against her will to sexual intercourse with him, they will not find her guilty of murder in the first degree. And he also asked that the words "any woman" in the Missouri rape statute quoted above embrace slave women as well as free white women. Jameson's proposed instructions challenged Missouri's slave law, which held that since the owned woman was property, what we would view as the rape of an enslaved woman by someone other than her master was actually considered trespass. And as Milton McLaurin summarizes the legal quandary posed by this definition, an owner could hardly be charged with trespassing upon his own property. Now, Judge Hall refused to present Jameson's self-defense arguments to the jury. On October the 10th, 1855, Celia was found guilty and ordered hanged by the neck until dead on the 16th day of November, 1855. In the meantime, either during or shortly after her trial, Celia's pregnancy ended in a stillbirth. Now, on the Missouri Supreme Court, Jameson appealed to the Missouri Supreme Court, and he asked for and he expected a stay of execution until such time as that court ruled. The court agreed to hear the case, but they refused the stay of execution. My God, I've got to pause here. I can't contain myself. Now, remember, this is white Christian America. This is a slave woman. I pointed out to you earlier that slavery is not a violation of the Bible, not a violation of the law of God. No problem in having the slave, but does this slave have the right to self-defense? Does this slave have a right to testify in her own defense? Shouldn't this slave woman have a right to be protected from rape? Did God in the Bible, through Moses, give slaves any kind of protection? Are there any laws in the Bible that regulate the use of slaves? And if so, do we find any violations? I think you're going to be shocked when we get to the bondservant statute and you find out that yes, indeed, the law that says thou shalt not commit adultery applies to slaves. That the law that provides for slavery does not provide for rape. And even though Newsom had a right to a slave, he had no right to force this woman into adultery or fornication against her will and over objection. And there was a protection prescribed by Moses that if you harm the slave, you have to release her. She should have been released because of the rape. But she wasn't released. And when she defended herself, she was prosecuted for murder. She was denied an opportunity to testify in her own defense. And then, to add insult to injury, the Supreme Court says, yes, we will listen to her appeal, but no, we will not stay the execution. Pray tell, if you were to determine after she had been hung that she was innocent or had the right to self-defense, would it then make any difference? Now, we wonder, white America, why it is that these blacks are so enraged at the injustices that have been perpetrated against them. And in the Bible, it's called the oppression of strangers. Now, there's a day of recompense coming, all of you black people out there. Sit back and relax and enjoy the show. The God of white Christian America is on the prod. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of white Christian America, is going to avenge these crimes. He said in the New Testament, this is Jesus, he said, there's nothing that has been hidden from view that will not be brought out into the full, broad daylight of the 12 noon sun. Now, this is just one case out of many, boys and girls. I just picked Celia the slave. I could have picked Dred Scott. I could have picked 40 other examples of this kind of oppression against strangers. I just happened to pick this one. Now, I'm not an advocate for blacks. I'm not an advocate for integration. Or school busing or anti-school busing or I'm here as an advocate for law and order, an advocate for the law of God. And here in America, we don't practice the law of God. We practice the law of the state, and the law of the state is called Christianity. We practice a religious ideology called Christianity, which is foreign and alien to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's foreign and alien to the laws of the Bible. It is a law of itself. I've pointed that out to you time and time again, and I wanted to show you that in this case with Celia. Now, the conclusion is this. Remember, the court agreed to hear the case, but refused to stay of execution. Some unidentified but presumably outraged Callaway County residents kidnapped Celia from jail just before her scheduled execution and then returned her once the date had passed. There were some outraged citizens that saved her life before the Supreme Court could act, so that the Supreme Court could listen to her case and then returned her. Jameson wrote a personal letter to one of the three Missouri Supreme Court justices. Two of the justices sitting in 1855, Judge William Scott and John F. Ryland, had participated in issuing the infamous pro-slavery Dred Scott decision, which would be upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1857. Jameson wrote in to the third justices, Judge Abiel Leonard, saying Judge Hall had cut out all means of defense, begging for a stay of execution, and pleading with the justices to please give the matter your earliest attention. So the Supreme Court rendered its decision on December 14, 1855, and they said, quote, upon an examination of the record and proceedings of the Circuit Court of Callaway County in the above case, it is thought proper to refuse the prayer of the petitioner, there being seen upon inspection of the record aforesaid no probable cause for such appeal, nor so much doubt as to render it expedient to take the judgment of the Supreme Court thereon, and it is thereby ordered by the court that an order for the stay of execution in this case be refused. Celia was interviewed by Fulton Telegraph reporter on December the 20th. She said, as soon as I struck him, the devil got into me, and I struck him with the stick until he was dead, and then rolled him in the fire and burned him up. She was hanged on December the 21st, 1855. Now, we got to take a break here, boys and girls, so let's take our break. Let me give you a couple of reminders, and we'll come back and analyze this case in the light of the statutes from Moses, and I'm going to show you another destroyed argument. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, for more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact discs. Now, for more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log, schedule, and archive. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or a local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember the website georgegordon.org or call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. All right, let's take a look at the statutes in the scripture, and I want to show you that this woman, Celia, the slave, was oppressed by her master. She was oppressed by the courts. She was oppressed in every way imaginable, and the laws that were designed to protect her were violated by white Christian judges. Oh, I'm sure that they were all white. In fact, the record shows that they were all white Callaway County. This woman was black. She was a slave, 14 years old, repeatedly raped by her master. Did her master have a right to rape her because she was property of her master? Well, let me ask you this. Would a man who owns a cow have a right to rape the cow? After all, the cow is his property. Don't you know that there is a law that says you shall not lie with a beast of the field, that it's bestiality, that it's a capital felony? Why then would we say, as the court reasoned in this case, that because this woman was a slave, it would violate the slave property's, the slave owner's property rights in his slave? Are we then to believe that slave owners had the right to rape their slave? Indeed, did he even have a right to have sexual relations with a woman who was not of his same race? Didn't we see that God has instructed us in Deuteronomy 7 that we are not to take to wife those of foreign and alien nations? And didn't Ezra and Nehemiah chastise the Israelites for having taken strange wives? Take a look at Ezra and Nehemiah. It'd be about Ezra 8, 9, or 10, Nehemiah 10. Take a look at Deuteronomy 7, about the first six verses, and that'll tell you that story right there. Boys and girls, there's no such thing on planet Earth under the laws of the God of Abraham as sexual relations outside of marriage. There's nothing in this record that would indicate that Mr. Newsom was married to Celia the slave. He was practicing fornication. He was practicing miscegenation. He was practicing interracial marriage or miscegenation with a stranger. He was oppressing a stranger. This stranger had been kidnapped. I'm going to show you the kidnap statute here in just a moment. Let's take a look at strangers. What did God tell us about how do you deal with people of ethnic or racial backgrounds other than white Anglo-Saxon WASP? How do you deal with the Asiatics and the blacks, the strangers that are within our midst? Well, in Exodus 22:21, there's a statute that says, "You shall neither vex a stranger nor oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt." In Exodus 23:9 also, "You shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger, seeing you were strangers in the land of Egypt." Exodus 29:33, "And they shall eat those things wherewith the atonement was made to consecrate and to sanctify them, but a stranger shall not eat thereof, because they're holy." Strangers have their place, and they're not to be oppressed, and they're not to be abused. Now in Leviticus 19:33 and 34, "If a stranger sojourn with you in the land, you shall not vex him, but the stranger that dwelleth with you shall be unto you as one born among you, and you shall love him as yourself, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Eternal your God." These people are to be treated in exactly the same way that we would treat one of our brothers. Now, do we treat these people this way? Have we treated them this way in the past? Now, there's probably 20 statutes in here on strangers. I'm not going to read all of the stranger statutes. I've code-pled them out in my book called The Mosaic Law. There are 133 subject matters, of which one of the subject matters is the stranger statute. It's number 114. Every law in the Bible and every penalty that is ascribed to the violation of this stranger statute is located here in these Nine pages of material on strangers. So this woman had a right to be treated just like those that were born in the land. Did the law that said that any woman who is against her will forced or coerced, should that jury instruction have been given to the jury? Was this black woman protected under the law of God in the same way that a white woman was protected under this stranger statute? I submit to you, boys and girls, that yes, she was. And was she abused and oppressed? Yes, she was. And was she wrongfully killed? Yes, she was. And who was it that did it to her? Oh, white Christians. Now, I told you that this woman was kidnapped. Now, let me show you something. Let me show you why we got punished with the Civil War and why we've been punished with this thorn in our side. In Exodus 21, verse 16, "And he that stealeth a man and selleth him, or if he be found in his hand, he shall surely be put to death." Deuteronomy 24:7, "If a man be found stealing any of his brethren of the children of Israel, and maketh merchandise of him, or selleth him, then that thief shall die, and you shall put evil away from among you." Did you get that? If a man be found stealing any of his brethren of the children of Israel. Now remember, under the stranger statute, we are to treat these strangers like one that is home-born. This woman was born in the land. And the statute in Deuteronomy 24, if a man be found stealing any of his brethren of the children of Israel, and maketh merchandise of him, or selleth him, then the thief shall die, and you shall put evil away from among you. If somebody had stolen Celia and sold her to somebody else, it would have been man-stealing. Let me ask you this. Where did those black Africans come from? Didn't they come from Africa? Were those black Africans defeated in war, or were they captured, kidnapped, and then transported against their will to the United States and sold as slaves over here? Because I'm going to show you here that under the Bondsman Statute, and under the statute concerning war, we can take slaves and make them slaves or bondservants forever. You can't make a Hebrew a bondservant past 7 years, but you can make a black or an Indian or an Eskimo or anybody else that you capture in war a slave forever. And you can buy them, you can sell them, you can trade them. It's a social status created by God under the Bondsman Statute. But you can't harm them. You can't gouge their eyes out. You can't rape them. And if you do gouge their eyes out, if you do cause a blemish, if you do beat this guy and you harm him, then you have to release him for his eyes' sake, or you have to release him. This woman had been oppressed. She had been raped. She was entitled to release under the bondsman statute, and she wasn't released. She was entitled to be protected against rape. She wasn't. And she had been kidnapped. Her kin, her family, her line, her lineage had been kidnapped. Now, this is the penalty that all of us white Anglo-Saxons are going to pay. Number one, we got our comeuppance with the Civil War. It killed 600,000 of us, disrupted our country, and it has never been the same since. The violation of that law, kidnapping those people from Africa and bringing them over here, was a mistake. Back in Genesis 10 and 11, God separated all of the races and gave them their inheritance. Going over to Africa and stealing the inheritance, and indeed stealing the people out of Africa to bring them over to the United States, was a crime. A crime that we're all paying for, have been paying for, and will continue to pay for some time to come. Now that's our penalty. But there's more to the story. Now, there's two statutes here that deal with man-stealing. It's against the law to go over to Africa, steal people, bring them over here, and make merchandise out of them. Now, that's what we did. Now, once they're over here, it's against the law to oppress a stranger that's within your gate. And we've been over here oppressing these people for some 200 or 300 years. All right, now let me flip over here to the bondsman statute, and let's listen to some of these statutes that deal with bondservants. In Genesis 21:9 through 11, just to establish slavery, Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, which she had borne unto Abraham, mocking. Wherefore she said unto Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be the heir with my son, even with Isaac. And the thing was very grievous in Abraham's sight because of his son. So slavery was very ancient. Abraham had slaves. The Bible calls them bondservants. And under the bondservant statutes, it tells you how you're to deal with and how you are to treat these people that are called bondservants. Leviticus 19:20, whosoever lies carnally with a woman that is a bondmaid, betrothed to a husband, and not at all redeemed, nor her freedom given her, she shall be scourged, but she shall not be put to death, because she was not free. Now if your brethren be waxen poor, now in Leviticus 25, verses 25 through 46, this is a long statute on bondservants. Hebrews can be taken into bond servitude. George Gordon could have a hole bored through his ears, sold to somebody. And then at the end of 7 years, I have to be released. And if I'm not released, I could be held until the 49th year if I had suffered some damage or caused some damage to somebody and I couldn't pay it off. Now, if I went out here and I was driving my car down the road and I ran somebody off the road and I killed them, the penalty is an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, wound for wound, and stripe for stripe, but I could ransom my life back. I could pay a ransom, but if the guy wouldn't accept the ransom, then I would have to be taken out and killed in the like manner in which I killed somebody. That's the statute called an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Christians, of course, reject all of these laws, all of these statutes, all of these judgments. And remember, I've showed you in the past, this is the covenant, this is the contract that God says, I've got a quarrel with you white Anglo-Saxons because you've breached my contract. We have an agreement and you didn't make the payments. Now it's time for foreclosure. I showed you last week. Hurricane Katrina is part of the foreclosure, and it's just the tip of the iceberg. And he said to us in Leviticus 26, if you won't be reformed by all of this, I'm going to punish you 7 times more for your sins. Now, the reason that I bring this up in destroyed arguments is because we have a belief here in the United States that you should spill your guts to the police, that the government, that the state is beneficent, it's righteous, it's holy, it's good. And if you don't have anything to hide, you shouldn't have any fear at confessing. Now, I showed you Vera Stretz. She shut her mouth and won her case. And I just showed you the case of Celia the Slave. She spilled her guts. She was totally innocent. Spilled her guts and said, this is what I did and here's why I did it. Now, she's got one condemning factor. If she acted in self-defense, then why did she burn the body? Why did she dispose of the evidence? See, that's prima facie evidence of intent. But why wasn't she allowed to speak in her own defense? You know, at the mouth of 2 witnesses or 3 witnesses shall the matter be established. She had a right to speak in her own defense under the Mosaic law, but she was denied that right. King David interviewed a man one time who said that he had killed Saul. And the man confessed to killing Saul, and he said, I did it for you, King David. I did it because I expected a reward. And King David said, out of your own mouth have you condemned yourself. Now, going on here, I'm going to skip over Leviticus 25 because that deals with white Anglo-Saxons, deals with people like you and me. If we're in bond servitude, if I've caused a damage to somebody and I'm in bond servitude, I could be held up to 49 years, but I've got to be released. And this gives you all of the ins and outs as to how that works. And by the way, this is the year 2005, and this is the Land Sabbath year. Land Sabbath year this year. It's the year of release. Let me give you a couple of more. In Deuteronomy 23, verse 15 and 16, you shall not deliver unto his master the servant which is escaped from his master unto you. He shall dwell with you, even among you, in that place which he shall choose in one of your gates, where he liketh him best. You shall not oppress him. Now remember, they rescued this woman out of jail. And then they turned her back over again. Some good people rescued the woman. This statute says, why did you turn them back over? I'm sure she didn't want to go back. Now, it's true, she's being charged with a crime here. She isn't escaped from her master. She could have ran away from her master, but you know what they did with runaway slaves? They cut their feet off. They mutilated them. There was nothing in the law that provided for mutilation of slaves that had escaped. And this thing of whipping and beating slaves was strictly controlled. Yes, if the slave was disobedient, he could be disciplined. But gouging his eye out would be grounds for releasing him. If you cut his fingers off or his hands off, you had to release him for the mutilations. Against the law to mutilate a slave. Called bondservants in the scripture. Now, in Deuteronomy 7, verse 8, he says, "But because the Eternal loved you, and because he would keep the oath which he had sworn with your fathers, the Eternal brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you out of the house of bondsmen from the land of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt." Don't ever forget, white Anglo-Saxon wasps, that we were bondsmen. We were slaves in the land of Egypt. And every year at the Passover, it's a commemoration, an annual commemoration, like Memorial Day, like the 4th of July. And God said, "I don't ever want you to forget that you were slaves in the land of Egypt. You've got the heart of a stranger. Don't oppress the strangers." Today we call that discrimination. Discrimination. Those that have been discriminated against in the past or oppressed in the past say, we should pay them trillions of dollars in reparations. Have you ever heard that? There's a movement afoot, and they're telling us that we should be paying these reparations. Not according to the Scripture. There's no reparations due. In Ezekiel chapter 18, let me show you a little story over here. Ezekiel 18. Notice this. It says, "If a man is just and does that which is lawful and right and has not eaten upon the mountains and neither has lifted up his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel and neither has defiled his neighbor's wife, neither has come near to a menstruous woman, has not oppressed any but has restored to the debtor his pledge, has spoiled none by violence, has given his bread to the hungry and has covered the naked with a garment, he that hath not given forth upon usury and neither hath taken any increase, that hath withdrawn his hand from iniquity, hath executed true judgment between man and man, has walked in my statutes and has kept my judgments to deal truly, he is just, he shall surely live, says the Eternal." So if you obey God and keep his commandments, you shall not die, you shall live. Verse 10, "If he begets a son that's a robber, a shedder of blood, and does the like to any of these things, and does not any of those duties, but even has eaten upon the mountains, defiled his neighbor's wife, has oppressed the poor and the needy, spoiled and has spoiled by violence, has not restored the pledge, has lifted up his eyes to the idols and has committed abomination, has given forth upon usury, and has taken increase, shall he then live? He shall not live. He's done all of these abominations, and he shall surely die, and his blood shall be upon him." Third group, verse 14, he says, "Now lo, if he begets a son that sees all of his father's sins which he has done, and considers and does not such like, that has not eaten upon the mountains, neither has lifted his eyes upon the idols of the house of Israel, has not defiled his neighbor's wife, neither has oppressed any, has not withholden the pledge, neither has spoiled by violence, but has given his bread to the hungry and has covered the naked with a garment, that has taken off his hand from the poor, that has not received usury nor increase, has executed my judgments, has walked in my statutes, he shall not die for the iniquity of his father, he shall surely live. As for his father, because he cruelly oppressed, spoiled his brother by violence, and did that which is not good among his people, lo, even he shall die in his iniquity." Now, did you get the point here? Verse 19 spells it out in spades. It says, "Yet say you, why? Does not the son bear the iniquity of the father? When the son has done that which is lawful and right, and has kept all of my statutes and has done them, he shall surely live. The soul that sinneth, it shall die. The son shall not bear the iniquity of the father, and neither shall the father bear the iniquity of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon him, and the iniquity of the wicked shall be upon him." Well, boys and girls, those of us living today do not owe those blacks 5 cents for any of the deprivations that were committed against them by any past generation. I do not owe any recompense for the death of Celia the slave. I don't owe any black 5 cents for any time that he spent in slavery or that his granddaddy spent in slavery at any time for any cause or reason, and neither does anybody else. Now, of course, this is the law of God. This is the law of Moses. This is the law of the God of Abraham. This is not the law of Christians. This is not the law of the United States. We don't practice this law. I just wanted to bring it to your attention. And the reason I'm bringing it to your attention is because Celia the slave violated one of those cardinal rules of keep your mouth shut. don't say anything, and then shut up. There wasn't any evidence. And all of the evidence that was used against her, even though she was innocent, even though she had every right to self-defense, even though she had been brutally oppressed, violated, raped, she was hung by the neck until she was dead. Now these people, boys and girls, have been kidnapped from Africa. That's the crime, not slavery. These people have been oppressed in this land. That's called the oppression of strangers within your gate. That's a crime. That's a violation of law, not slavery. We have it in our minds that holding these people as slaves was the crime. That wasn't the crime, never was. The fact that Celia was a slave wasn't a crime. The fact that Celia was oppressed as a stranger and kidnapped from Africa was the crime, for which the God of Abraham has punished us in the past, is punishing us today, and is going to punish us even more severely in the future for those two crimes, not the slavery, kidnapping and oppression. Now, oftentimes we hear the controversy over Roe v. Wade and abortion. Abortion in the Bible is called passing your seed through the fire to Moloch. It happens that murder is a crime punishable by death, and it happens that passing your seed through the fire to Moloch is a crime that is punishable by death. But abortion is not murder. Abortion is passing your seed through the fire to Moloch, for which the death penalty should be invoked. That's another destroyed argument. Well, that's, of course, if you wanted to get your law from the Bible rather than getting your law from the Congress of the United States or from your state legislature, which are, by the way, called foreign and alien gods in the Bible, which is strictly prohibited, remember, in the first commandment that says, "You shall have no other gods before me." Now, we Americans have gone out and gotten birth certificates, marriage licenses, driver's licenses, business licenses, plumber's licenses, contractor's licenses. If there's a license that you can get from the state, we've got them. And we wallow in them. And we revel in these licenses. But to call it righteousness, I think, is an argument that should be exposed and destroyed for what it is. So I thought I'd take this week and we'd take a look at some of these legal arguments that are being promulgated. Larry Beecraft started the story with destroyed arguments, so I intervened in the destroyed arguments by Larry Beecraft. Now, next time when we come back, I'm going to take up Larry Beecraft's destroyed arguments again. These last two programs didn't have anything to do with Larry Beecraft, so I don't want you to blame Larry. So we'll see you next time here on the Law Hour, and we'll take up destroyed arguments next time from Larry Beecraft's treatise when we come back. All right, you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember that the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.